Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, August 16th, 2019. Our weekly guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer who joins me today from New York. Welcome back, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, welcome back indeed, Andrew, or as they say in Paris, bon retour, mon vieux. While the Albanese family went for a grand tour of Europe, Jim Milliot, PW executive editor, sat in for you the last couple of weeks. We enjoyed talking with him, but it's great to have you back. But don't put your passport away just yet, though. Let's open the show this week on an international note. Looming tariffs on Bibles and children's books printed in China, along with many other products made in China, including toys and electronics, were postponed this week. For publishers, though, this represents only a partial reprieve, as the prospect for tariffs still remains for adult books. How is that news going down?
Yeah, well, good news that Bibles and kids' books were exempted, but the other stuff, not well, as you might imagine. As you note, the U.S. Trade Representative this week excluded kids' books, Bibles, other religious books from the 10% tariffs that would have been subjected as of September 1. Tariffs on those books have now been delayed till December 15th, I believe. And notably, President Trump later acknowledged that the reason they delayed them till December 15th was to get us through the holiday season, which is awfully curious because, wait, China's paying for those tariffs, aren't they? Well, no. In fact, that statement by Trump seems to finally be an acknowledgement of the obvious, that tariffs are in fact a tax and that we, the U.S. consumers, pay them. Anyway, back to the point, adult trade books are still subject to those 10% tariffs without an action in the coming weeks. And that could certainly dent publishers' bottom lines. Now, remember, books are already priced pretty high, right? They're already like luxury items in a lot of cases. Hardcovers are $30. So it's hard to imagine that publishers would be willing to pass on that extra 10% tariff onto book buyers without seriously hurting their sales. So I imagine that if those tariffs come to pass, most publishers are just going to end up eating some or all of that 10%, which is really going to hurt their earnings.
So is there any hope that these tariffs on trade books would be delayed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as with all things Trump, you never really know what's real, right? And, you know, do I think publishers will have a meaningful voice in influencing that policy? However, I really don't. Trump has little love for books in the media business, so I don't know that a trade representative hearing from the publishing industry is going to make a difference. After all, you know, John Sargent and Macmillan used Donald Trump's attempt to silence Michael Wolff in 2018 as a way to sell, in Sargent's words, a shitload of copies of Fire and Fury. So, you know, I can't imagine that Trump is going to lift the tariff on books just so, you know, Joe Scarborough's upcoming Trump book, which is titled This Ends Badly, by the way, just so that book can sell more copies. And frankly, I have to say, I don't think the AAP or what's left of the AAP is going to be very, very useful in this a policy fight of this nature. You know, they've been sort of retooling as a copyright organization, which is what AAP boss Maria Palante is, of course, known for. But from where I sit and from what I hear, there's not really much clout there when it comes to these bigger issues with the Trump administration. I mean, there's only so much a small, what is it, like 10 or 11 person crew in Washington can do. And you have all these different issues. You have antitrust and tech policy on the radar now for AAP and copyright, of course, which is a big focus. And it's not like Maria Palante is a former member of Congress, like Tom Allen, for example, or Pat Schroeder, previous AAP heads who still had friends in high places that might owe them for a vote they made back in the day. So I think the best we can hope for is that Trump will not be able to say he's making progress against China if our own economy starts to take a hit in the form of these tariffs and he, you know, has to back off, I think. So I think that's all still possible, maybe even likely that Trump is going to back off. Anyway, worth watching in the coming weeks, as we will be doing here at Publishers Weekly.
Also in the news this week, Andrew, is word that the works of J.D. Salinger will no longer be available only in print. All of his books, including the classic Catcher in the Rye, are set to be released as ebooks.
Yeah, that's kind of a big deal, right? So, you know, Little Brown, in conjunction with the estate of J.D. Salinger, announced plans this week to finally release ebook editions of Salinger's four beloved works of fiction. That's The Catcher in the Rye, of course, Nine Stories, Franny and Zoe, and Raise High the Roof Beam, Carpenters, and Seymour, An Introduction. These are all coming out in ebook editions. The ebooks are going to be available this week, as a matter of fact. And it's worth noting that the release of the ebooks is also going to be accompanied by a special focus on libraries. There's going to be a 1,000 ebook giveaway sweepstakes to public libraries. That's 250 copies of all four titles to North American libraries. In addition, Little Brown is offering the new ebook editions to libraries at a special discounted ebook price through December 31st, I think. So I thought that was curious. You know, at a time when the library ebook market is viewed as hurting sales by some publishers, I thought it was curious to see a marketing plan for a new release ebook that's, you know, actually focusing on libraries and its marketing efforts.
Indeed. And I guess we have to ask, why did the Salinger Estate hold out from producing an ebook edition for quite so long?
That's a really good question. And I think you framed it just right. It's the Salinger Estate here. You know, the story that's out in the media now is that the estate, which is now overseen by Salinger's son, Matthew, J.D. Salinger hated publishing, right? He was anti-technology, and that this whole ebook thing, well, it was just too much for him. He never wanted to do it. But Salinger's been dead for almost 10 years now. You know, so what really took Salinger's estate so long to get on this train, the ebook bandwagon here? We don't really know, but I'm reasonably sure that it wasn't because they were respecting the enigmatic writer's wishes after he passed. You know, it's important to point out that J.D. Salinger's contracts predated digital books, so it's quite likely that the author did indeed hold the ebook rights, which surely were not enumerated in the contract, and I'm sure Salinger wasn't leaping at the time to add a clause to his contracts about these, given his feelings on publishing. And by the time the Kindle actually launched in 2007, Salinger wasn't really agreeing to anything anymore. He was just a few years away from his death. Certainly, that's not something I imagine him making a priority. We're also now in the back nine of the copyright protection for The Catcher in the Rye. That may have something to do with this. I believe it enters the public domain in about 25 years. And I'm sure the royalty rates here were an issue too. No way do I see the Salinger estate taking the, you know, standard 25% of net receipts that publishers offer. So it's hard to say what the real story is here. I'm just not buying any of the J.D. Salinger myths here.
And on the subject of library ebooks, Andrew, in Monday's issue, a PW columnist has an interesting take on the tensions in that marketplace.
Yeah, a really great piece in Monday's issue from Joe James, one of our library columnists here, in which he acknowledges that the tension between libraries and publishers is really nothing new, but that in the ebook world and the digital world, it's now reaching new heights. Our listeners will recall in his memo to authors and agents announcing Macmillan's two-month embargo on new release ebooks, CEO John Sargent all but blamed libraries for depressing ebook sales and author earnings. And that raised a perennial question that Joe James points out predates and actually extends beyond the current state of the ebook market. Do publishers and authors see the library's relationship to them as more symbiotic or parasitic? And it's clear, for whatever reason, in the digital space, that publishers today are seeing it more as the latter. And until a more accurate perception of libraries takes root among publishing executives, James points out, it's hard to see the library ebook market improving. The column is provocatively titled, too. It's titled, Do Libraries Hate Publishers? The answer, of course, is no, not really. It's a great read. Go check it out.
And on Thursday, we learned that educational publisher Cengage, check that, educational content provider Cengage, is being sued by its authors for a second time over its switch from publishing textbooks to managing digital subscriptions. You reported on the first suit, which was filed in May of last year and was settled in October. Anything new in this suit?
Yeah, deja vu all over again, right? This is the second time in just over a year that a group of textbook authors has filed a proposed class action suit against publisher Cengage, alleging that the company's digital pivot actually violates their author agreements. This suit was filed this week in the Southern District of New York by a group of authors, and it claims that Cengage is basically cheating their authors out of proper royalties for sales through its digital products. That's Cengage Unlimited, which is the subscription access to all of Cengage content, and MindTap, which is a more than five-year-old service that actually enhances Cengage digital text with multimedia capabilities, things like quizzes and homework help, etc. So in other words, the suit alleges that because Cengage isn't selling print textbooks anymore, it isn't paying a print textbook royalty, but rather is paying authors pursuant to a formula that it alone has determined. As you note, Those claims should sound familiar because last October, Cengage settled the suit, a similar suit by two authors who claimed that the publisher had wrongfully implemented a unilateral change to the compensation structure for its authors when it switched from the typical royalty on sale model to this relative use model, which of course pays authors just a fractional percentage of Cengage's revenues based on how the work was used.
Well, I know we talked about the first suit last year, and you thought it was a loser at the time. What about this new suit?
Yeah, I did think the first suit was a loser because I actually had a chance to see the contracts in question then. And basically, as Cengage pointed out in its answer to that first suit, the author agreements include both the full and complete transfer of copyright to the publisher and the explicit right to publish digital editions in exchange for a cut of net receipts. And maybe most importantly, they did not contain audit clauses. And more on that in a second. You know, as to the chance of the new suit succeeding, it's hard for me to say at this point because I haven't had a chance yet to see the contracts. But I'll say this. One, this suit comes a year after the launch of Cengage Unlimited, rather than prior to the launch. So there may be a lot more interest among authors who are noticing a change in their royalty statements. And two, this suit may indeed serve a purpose. If most authors, like those that filed suit last year, don't have audit clauses in their contracts, and most probably don't, litigation may be the only way to get a good look at how Cengage is actually calculating payments. So whether or not Cengage or the authors prevail in this suit or can prevail in this suit, the litigation at the very least suggests the need for more transparency about how Cengage is calculating payments and whether or not they are doing so fairly. And on a final note, I have to add this too, that Cengage issued a statement on the suit, and I actually found it to be a little ham-fisted. Basically, it said, we're here trying to keep the prices low for students. Those are their new talking points, right? They're out there saying this new digital subscription is about keeping prices low, low prices for students. And they note that it's kind of sad that these, you know, what they imply anyway, are these greeting authors who are trying to keep us from doing that. Well, you know, Cengage is in the midst of merging with McGraw-Hill. It's a blockbuster merger that's starting to attract a lot of attention and a lot of opposition from stakeholders and regulators. In an industry that's admittedly gouged consumers for decades, and for a company that has recently emerged from bankruptcy, I'm a little hesitant to see them pointing the finger at authors in this way and at academics. I mean, it's not a good idea. It really won't matter in the case. It's not going to matter much in the court of public opinion either. But among authors and observers, that won't go unnoticed.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks so much for the reporting and the analysis.
My pleasure, as always.
Up next on Beyond the Book, in 2017, University of Virginia professor Bruce Halsinger realized he'd seen many an acknowledgement page where a male author thanked an anonymous wife for typing his book manuscript. Halsinger tweeted several screenshots and accompanying scornful wisecracks under the hashtag #ThanksForTyping. Immediately, the Twitter world responded in kind, finding myriad examples when otherwise invisible women, many of them authors themselves, had typed, translated, edited, and proofread. At the Thanks for Typing Oxford Conference in March 2019, American writer and publisher Karen Christensen presented a paper on the lives of two secretaries who became two literary wives, Sophia Mumford, wife of the American historian and philosopher Lewis Mumford, and Valerie Elliott, second wife of T.S. Eliot. Until very recently, Christensen notes, authors wrote while others typed.
We all do it ourselves now, but and we have all sorts of apps and programs to help us. But until very recently, people, even people who typed their own first drafts, they were very rough and ready, and they would hire a professional typist to prepare whatever they were going to turn into a journal or to a book publisher. And of course, this started long before the typewriter, which only goes back about 100 years. Milton's daughters transcribed Paradise Lost for their blind father. Leo Tolstoy's wife made fair copies, that is, handwritten copies, 8 of them, of different versions of War and Peace, as well as bearing 13 children. That's a level of devotion I find almost impossible to imagine.
Thanks for typing. Next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.